for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. U.S. and Iraqi negotiators have agreed to a plan that calls for withdrawal of U.S. combat troops from Iraqi cities by next June and from the country as a whole by 2011. The plan must still be approved by Iraqi leaders and its parliament. 67 people were killed in suicide attacks in Pakistan yesterday, and Russian troops are said to be pulling back from some parts of Georgia. Joining me for these and other top international stories, Khaled Hassan. He's U.S. correspondent for Daily Times and the Friday Times of Lahore, Pakistan. Julian Barnes is Pentagon reporter for the Los Angeles Times, and Scott Wilson is foreign editor of the Washington Post. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Julian Barnes, if I could start with you first. What have the U.S. and the Iraqi negotiators agreed to, and what's still up in the air?
Well, the key element here is that the U.S. has agreed to pull out of the cities by next June. This is sort of a return to the old strategy where the U.S. was on the big bases and away from what they've been doing for the last year and a half of pushing out the troops into the cities, into these small combat outposts. They've also agreed to take out the combat troops by 2011, which is a year later than what the Iraqi government wanted. And they've also agreed that contractors can be held liable by the Iraqi government. What's outstanding, though, is the treatment of U.S. soldiers. It's a red line for the U.S. They do not want the Iraqi courts to have any jurisdiction over U.S. soldiers. The Iraqis are not satisfied with that.
Let's take the first part of that. I'm interested because hadn't the Bush administration, Scott Wilson, repeatedly rejected the idea of any kind of timetable?
They have, and although in recent months they've showed signs of backing away from that, they'd always said that a timetable essentially gives any Iraqi faction or Iran from the outside a timetable, a deadline, when just to wait out, essentially, to begin their sectarian fight or to begin a push inside Iraq to take control. So they did not want to set anything down in paper to give people who might disrupt the political process and the security gains an opportunity to think strategically about the future and what their plan would be. That has changed more recently, though, with increased Iraqi pressure on the Americans to say we need a deadline. Maliki, the prime minister of Iraq, is under enormous domestic pressure to secure that kind of an arrangement. Internal Shiite politics is driving some of this, and the looming provincial elections, which have not been set yet but will be, a lot of that has put pressure on the White House to say, okay, we need to do something and put something down on paper.
Does it also indicate that the U.S. seems to have more faith in the Iraqi troops than previously?
Yes, I think that has been the case, really. And although, you know, sometimes you think that progress has been made and sometimes there are setbacks, but withdrawals are always difficult. They are problematic. And although a deadline has been given, one can never really be sure if the deadline can be adhered to, because unforeseen things can happen.
Julian, you mentioned the concern regarding U.S. soldiers. Spell that out.
Well, you know, what has worked over the last year and a half is spreading out U.S. soldiers into the cities so that the Iraqi people have a greater sense of security and that the Iraqi army is backed up not just by embedded trainers, but also a nearby American unit. You know, much earlier in the war, under General Metz, when he was the number two commander, and under General Casey, when he was the overall commander, what they said they wanted to do is pull back into these super bases, places like Camp Victory, you know, these sprawling bases away from the city, and let the Iraqi army go on its own. But the problem is the Iraqi army wasn't ready for that. Mm. Now, what the Iraqi government is saying is Basra, Sadr City, Mosul, all these operations have shown that the Iraqi army is much stronger now. The question for the Americans is, how quickly do they push forward that army? Because if they go too fast, you know, a lot of the gains could be erased.
Scott.
And I think it is also important to remember in this agreement, which is known as a status of forces agreement, is that these points that we're talking about timelines, have been agreed to between negotiators. But as Julian said, the idea of how Iraqi jurisdiction will apply to U.S. soldiers is not, and that's a huge issue. So the whole agreement is still, you know, in doubt and could be and could eventually not work out.
So many of our listeners have raised the question about permanent U.S. bases there in Iraq. How big a deal is that right now, Scott?
Well, I think, as Julian's noting, that in consolidating these neighborhood bases back into these super bases, while it reduces the presence of U.S. troops in very visible positions in Iraqi cities, which gives the impression of foreign occupation, it also raises fears about these large bases aren't going anywhere among Iraqis. And so it is something that U.S. commanders sort of debate back and forth occasionally. And also in terms of the U.S. soldiers' immunity, I think that there is some progress being made because I think, and Julian can correct me if I'm wrong, that they're trying to make a distinction between on-duty and off-duty soldiers. Those off-duty soldiers that commit crimes may be subject to Iraqi jurisdiction, while on-duty soldiers who may be accused of war crimes would not be. That may be some way that they can reach an agreement on that issue.
And also, well, of course, we're in the midst of a U.S. presidential campaign. So the question becomes, could everything or some of what's been agreed to now change in light of a changing administration? Khaled.
Yes, absolutely. You know, we don't know really what shape it might take, but I think the Iraqi desire that the U.S. forces withdraw at some point is very genuine and very real and should be understandable because nobody really likes foreign troops on its soil.
Julia.
I think that if an Obama administration was elected, you could see this sort of timetable speed up because it is that's what Obama has said he wanted. That is what the Iraqis wanted. But I think the sort of basic negotiating positions over the rights of U.S. soldiers, the rights of Iraqi courts, they wouldn't change dramatically.
Julian Barnes, he's Pentagon reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Scott Wilson, foreign editor for The Washington Post, and Khaled Hassan, he's U.S. correspondent for Daily Times and the Friday Times of Lahore, Pakistan. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Scott Wilson, what's the latest on Russia's position in Georgia? Are they indeed pulling out?
Yesterday it was very unclear. This morning it really does look like, according to reports from the region, that there is a significant Russian withdrawal from Georgian cities, heading back to South Ossetia and Abkhazia, the two breakaway Georgian enclaves that are at the heart of this conflict. So it does appear that they are. Yesterday, however, the foreign minister of Russia, Sergei Lavrov, did say that Russia intends to build 7 military outposts in what is Georgian territory, undisputed Georgian territory. And so whether that proceeds or not will certainly be a fairly significant bone of contention.
And what about independence for South Ossetia? It would seem that Russia is not going to allow that to happen, Julian.
Well, you know, that's been a controversial issue in Russia, whether to recognize these breakaway republics. It's a hard, you know, Russia wants to weaken Georgia, so recognition of those breakaway republics would do that. But on the other hand, they don't want to give any more autonomy to their own, to North Ossetia or to any other of the Caucasus region. So they are playing a very delicate game with the South Ossetians.
So what are we seeing that's happening here, at the larger picture between Russia and the United States? Scott?
Well, it appears that, you know, this is an opportunity that Russian Prime Minister Vladimir Putin, who still seems to be very much calling the shots, has been waiting for to some degree. The Georgian president, who's a favorite of the United States, shelled the South Ossetian capital of Skhinvali, brought Russian troops in. We're seeing some reports today that the American ambassador in Moscow was saying that Russia had some degree of cause for doing what they did, which is the first time we've heard that from an American official. But what we're seeing is what had been a brewing conflict over Georgia's place. It wants to join NATO. The Americans have encouraged that. Putin has been furious about American expansion of NATO right up to his doorstep, and so this was an opportunity to really show that Russia still considers Georgia, other Soviet former Soviet republics in Eastern Europe, very much part of its ambit.
Scott Wilson, foreign editor of the Washington Post. We'll take a short break. The lines are filled just now. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Welcome back to our International Friday News Roundup, this week with Khaled Hassan. He's a correspondent for Daily Times and the Friday Times of Lahore, Pakistan. Julian Barnes, Pentagon reporter for the Los Angeles Times, and Scott Wilson, foreign editor for the Washington Post. Here's an email from Bruce, who says, Mikhail Gorbachev wrote an op-ed piece for the Washington Post saying Russia was acting purely in self-defense, that much of the problem in the Georgia area was of U.S. origin, with our missile defense provocations on Russia's borders. No one among your punditry responded to that. Please ask your panel to discuss the Russian side of the Georgian conflict. And Scott, you mentioned that the U.S. ambassador to Russia had said that Russia did have some provocation.
Well, Russia had troops in South Ossetia that were characterized as peacekeepers. And when the Georgian attack came, there is jeopardy to those troops. And so one of the original arguments that Vladimir Putin made was, this is self-defense. We are protecting our soldiers. There's also, you know, the South Ossetians themselves consider themselves they have affinity for Russia. Many of them now hold Russian passports. Russia has been issuing these passports tactically to try to encourage an affinity for Russia. And so in some ways, they can argue they were protecting their own citizens in this conflict.
The question becomes one of overreaction on the part of the Russians, however. Also, the question for the South Ossetians was how angry they became with the Georgians themselves.
Yeah, and don't forget the Georgians overreacted to, every August the South Ossetians have been firing into Georgia. There had been warnings by the United States to Georgia not to respond to this. And there are a lot of observers who believe the Georgian government just sort of stepped into a trap that Putin laid, that Putin wanted them to overplay their hands to give Russia an excuse. But clearly there were tensions brewing that neither of the sides of this have acted with pure intentions.
Where does this go, Khaled?
Well, I would like to make one point that the coverage of this war in the American press has been extremely one-sided. And in fact, it was the Georgians who first committed aggression. But this has gone by default. And in fact, I recall just a few days ago, a Russian young woman who is an intern at the Washington Post, she wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post saying that she's absolutely cannot believe what she reads. And therefore, the coverage has been very, very prejudiced, very one-sided.
I read that piece. Scott, how do you respond?
Well, I would dispute that. I think there's been some very interesting reconstructive reporting, both in our paper and in competing newspapers, that have charted the first few hours of how the war began and the first few days of how it played out. And to some degree, getting at precisely what we're saying, there's blame to be placed on both sides. Georgia certainly did shell Skinvali early on. There's a possibility that war crimes were committed there. And Russia did not only go into the enclaves, but push into Georgian territory in what some say is an overreaction. So I guess I would dispute that it's been one-sided. And there's been quite a bit of reporting and both in the op-ed pages and in other sections talking about the Georgian role historically in some of these places, which has not been good.
Here's an email from Carolyn in Jacksonville, Florida. A citizen of Abkhazia gave a moving defense of independence on the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer last night. Since the U.S. has managed to get independence for Kosovo, why are we defending Georgia's refusal to give independence to Abkhazia and Ossetia, especially since the cruelty of Georgians in both areas is still uppermost in the minds of many living in these areas? And is support from McCain's advisor at work in the support of Bush and McCain for Georgia? Julian.
Russians, of course, have been making the Kosovo analogy for months and months. If you looked at the Russian press, they were constantly bringing this up. Putin bringing it up himself. The administration's position was that this is something that should be solved internally to Georgia, that they recognize the historic boundaries and that there should be a solution through creating autonomy within Georgia. That was the preferred solution. They rejected the sort of Kosovo analogy. But there is, there are parallels there. And that's why the Russian case is not without merit. But the question really is self-governance, and could you do it without upsetting the very tricky borders there.
Khaled, last comment from you.
I think I'm in agreement with my friend. It is a very, it's very sensitive. You know, there are, there's a lot of history there. It's not an easy one, and it's not going to be an easy one. And I don't think we'll see peace come to that region of the world very soon.
Yeah. All right, let's move on. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice was in Warsaw on Wednesday, signed a deal with Poland on missile defense. She counseled Russia against threatening Poland. Scott.
Well, yes, I mean, this should be seen in the context of what is happening in the Caucasus as well. This agreement was negotiated for quite some time. The signing, the formalizing of it coincided with this, and the United States did not delay that, probably because it did not want to be seen as having its decisions dictated by Russian threats. But a Russian general did at the time say that because Poland is going to be stationing part of this missile defense system there, that it exposes itself to attacks. This was alarming words, and what Secretary of State Rice is saying is that she's condemning those statements, but it does show that what one of your email writers had suggested, that you know, this Russia sees this as of a piece, that the Americans are pushing this stuff right up into what they consider their traditional area of influence.
And what the foreign ministry said was that Russia in this case will be forced to react, and not only through diplomatic moves. What does that mean?
Well, you know, NATO, Secretary Rice, Secretary Gates in the United States have all said that this is sort of overblown, meaningless rhetoric by Russia, that they're trying to rattle the cage of the Polish. But it is, you know, it is not something the Poles want to hear. I mean, this is, and in fact, that kind of stepped up rhetoric is what sort of broke some of the log jams within Polish politics that said, hey, we want to not only we want to ensure that the United States is here to defend us right away. And one of the sticking points was that the Poles wanted a Patriot missile battery. And the United States was reluctant to do that because their whole point was this missile shield is not aimed at Russia, but a Patriot missile battery is for short-range missiles.
I see.
Where would they come from? Moscow.
So if Georgia had been a member of NATO, the U.S. would have had to go in and help Georgia. Now, the U.S. and Poland have signed a declaration of strategic cooperation. What does that mean, Khaled?
Frankly, that's a difficult one. I don't know, but could we be witnessing the beginnings of the Cold War?
Is that how you see it, Julian?
Well, I don't think that there's a new Cold War here yet, but this agreement is for the Poles is a way to ensure that they see America as a more reliable ally than some of the Western European countries, and they think the more they can bring the United States integrate the United States into the defense of Poland, the more secure they will be against a aggressive Russia.
And you raised an interesting point about NATO membership. Georgia is potentially going to be a NATO member, and if they had been, the alliance would have been obligated to do something on its defense. So, in some ways, there is a message here about being careful about who you're inviting in and what kind of things they're going to be doing. You may be walking down a road you're not sure where it's going to end.
All right, and turning to Pakistan, which has now set a date to elect its next president, September 6th. The main ruling party is backing its leader, Benazir Bhutto's widower, Asif Ali Zardari, to be the next president. What would that mean, Khaled, if that were to be the case?
Well, you know, they have a majority in the National Assembly, and they have the backing of a number of parties, the MQM, and some smaller groups, and some breakaway factions of the old Musharraf backers, the Pakistan Muslim League Q. They also seem to be siding with the People's Party, which is headed by Zardari. And therefore, I think Zardari's rise to the presidency of Pakistan, unthinkable not very long ago, it should be a given now. And I believe this is tied up with the issue of the judges' restoration, which is what is keeping the coalition at the federal level divided. But there has been an agreement of sorts today, and I believe by Monday they will settle the judges' issue. And in return, I think the Pakistan Muslim League of Nawaz Sharif, whom Musharraf deposed in a coup d'etat in October 1999, will, I think, back Asif Ali Zardari.
What happens to Musharraf now that he has resigned?
Well, he says he wants to live in Islamabad, he wants to play golf, he wants to play bridge. He says he doesn't want to live abroad. But there are two schools, really, you know. There are those who think that Musharraf should answer for what he has done. He should be tried for the violation of Article 6 of the Pakistani Constitution, which means if you overthrow a constitutionally, legally elected government, then you must suffer capital punishment, Article 6. And others say let bygones be bygones and let Musharraf go, and we should start from here and look ahead.
At 27 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. What do you think, Scott?
Well, I agree. It's a fairly startling and swift kind of turn of events for Zardari, and it does appear that with the coalition that he has behind him, it does seem inevitable. I believe that the date is September 6th is what we're seeing that they'll be choosing. It's done through the provincial parliaments and then the federal parliament as well. And with that sort of backing in those legislatures, it seems inevitable to some degree.
And also this week in Afghanistan, Julian, the Taliban staged some of the most brazen attacks in years. What's going on here?
Well, I was talking with a senior commander this week in Afghanistan who sort of had, when he was comparing now to his previous stints in Afghanistan, he said that the enemy is more sophisticated. The enemy is capable of mounting a wide variety of attacks, from one-person asymmetric bombings to massing troops and attacking U.S. and NATO forces.
Wow.
And this is an enemy that was tougher than it was a year ago, tougher than 2 years ago.
Now, how might Musharraf's resignation affect relations between Pakistan and Afghanistan, Scott?
Well, I think already some of this recent violence, yesterday the huge attack on an army munitions factory not far from Islamabad by the Taliban is taking advantage to some degree of a power vacuum. And Musharraf was seen at one point to be a real U.S. ally and a strong person against Taliban encroachments in Pakistan. But there's been some questions about the relationship and his ability to control Pakistan's very powerful intelligence services, which the Afghan government has said is behind some of the attacks that have taken place in Kabul, and the Indian government has as well. So it seems like a very murky situation, but the transition is a difficult time, and there's a lot of opportunity, I think, for the Taliban.
Khaled.
I don't think I'll call it a murky situation. Of course, it's a transition, and it's transitions are never easy. But the fact is that there is a civilian government in office now, and they are in effective command. And the Pakistan Army has most certainly decided to stay away and let the civilians manage things. For example, in the last election, February 18 election, and thereafter, the Pakistan Army and the ISI they never intervened. You know, they never sort of, as they used to do, run their favorites, or manipulate things. They stayed absolutely neutral. So that's a very good sign. And, you know, there was bad blood between Musharraf and Karzai. They had bad chemistry. Even President Bush tried hard to make them shake hands. And if you look at that photograph, you know, they are standing. On one side, Mr. Bush is smiling, and Musharraf looks very sullen, and Karzai doesn't look happy. But I think with the politicians in charge, especially Zardari, who is a very pragmatic sort of person, very relaxed, very easygoing, I think it should be possible to really revive the confidence in the relationship, which hasn't existed.
Julian.
There was a key development this week where Kiani, the head of the Pakistani army, went to Afghanistan to meet with his colleagues there, which may have been the first high-level coordination between the Pakistan army and the Afghanistan government. And the Americans have repeatedly said that this is key for getting the problem of the militants on both sides of the border under control.
Julian Barnes, Pentagon reporter for the Los Angeles Times. We'll take a short break, and when we come back, we'll open the phones, 800-433-8850.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Miriam Muscarolis and Grant Abramson, thanking the donors to the NPR Foundation and councils for their support of NPR programming. By the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. And by AMARC Foundation, supporting procon.org, with the 2008 presidential candidates' positions on many issues at procon.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, our series on presidential history and politics continues with two interviews about the Nixon years. We hear from Bud Crowe, one of Nixon's so-called plumbers. He approved a covert operation to break into the office of Daniel Ellsberg's psychiatrist. Also, Rick Perlstein talks about his book, Nixonland. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
And we're back with our International Friday News Roundup. Let's go first to Indianapolis. And Colleen, you're on the air. Go right ahead.
All right, thank you. Hi, how are you doing, Diana?
Fine, I love thanks.
I've been a huge fan. I think you're a cool gal. But
thank anyways, you.
My question, oh, sorry. Anyway, my question was, I was thinking about the South Ossetia, the Georgian thing, and I was wondering how much is it more about the gas issue instead of these huge genocide or things like that. And I just want to know your professional opinions on that.
Thank you. Julian.
Well, one reason the Russians may not have retreated to the original boundaries prior to the military action is so that they can give a warning to the West that they are within striking distance of the pipelines that go through Georgia. Russia has used its control of energy pipelines into Europe to as a lever of its foreign policy, and they want to keep doing that.
And now to Cecily here in Washington, D.C. You're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call. I'd like to go back to the question of Iran and our troop withdrawal. Back when they first started talking about a timetable, they talked about meeting certain benchmarks, and I was given to understand that one of these was the signing of an Iraqi oil law that the United States, at least to some degree, drafted. You don't hear much about that, and I wondered whether it played a role in the current agreement.
Scott.
The caller's absolutely right. There were this series of benchmarks. Every now and then we get a report card from the administration on how the Iraqi government is doing. The Iraqi oil law is definitely one of them. I don't know if the benchmarks and the negotiations on troop withdrawal are that tied together, except for the elements that have to do with security. The idea behind the U.S., the recent surge policy and all of that was to provide security so that the Iraqi government could make political process. It hasn't on that particular issue, or at least hasn't signed it officially. I don't think the two are that linked.
Here's an email from doesn't say whom. Wasn't Bhutto's husband one of the most corrupt members of her administration? Khaled.
You know, there has been have been allegations, and, you know, he spent nearly 11 years in jail, but he is unconvicted. In fact, he once said that he is the most acquitted man in the history of Pakistan. He got acquitted from, I think, 9 cases in Pakistani courts. And therefore, I think unless he is proven to be guilty, we should assume that he is innocent.
Julian.
The issue of corruption has dogged him throughout his career. It was one of the issues of why he wasn't going to be let back into Pakistan. This is also why he's resisting the restoration of the judges, if I'm not mistaken, that he fears that some of the amnesty agreements could be undone and that they could go after him on the corruption charges again if they restore the old judiciary.
Here's an email from Moxville, North Carolina. Mr. Bush is going to put part of the defense shield in Poland because of concerns about Iran. The lie is too obvious. It makes no sense at all to put defensive missiles on the north coast of Europe to protect against fear of missiles from a country in the Middle East, which does not have nuclear weapons. Do not be surprised when Mr. Putin puts missiles in Cuba to protect Russia from attacks originating in Venezuela.
Well, there are technical reasons for the trajectory of a ballistic, intercontinental ballistic missile, of why you need to put the missiles in Poland. We have our own interceptors, some of them in Alaska. There are technical reasons. But the writer is correct. The Russians have, on time, threatened to put missiles back in Cuba. That's probably more just hot air than a real threat.
All right, to Kalamazoo, Michigan. Good morning, Brian.
Good morning. Yeah, I just want to make a comment that I was kind of listening to the different news programs when the whole Georgia thing was going on, specifically the BBC and Canadian broadcasting, and I actually got on the internet one from an English from France, and their coverage seems to be much more equal faulting of both sides in this conflict. And you don't hear, you hear a little bit about the potential atrocities from the Georgian side, but you don't hear anything. And I'm just wondering if this is another case of, you know, what Iraq was 20 years ago, where we kind of looked at a blind eye because they were our friends, and then, you know, later it's like, now we go in and get them. And I just want to see what their comments were about that difference of bias, I guess.
All right. Khaled.
Well, I think that's the point I made earlier in the program. I would say that not always is truth published in newspapers. In fact, Orwell said that truth is never published in newspapers. But look at Musharraf. You know, he was in office for 9 years, and he could do nothing wrong, you know, as far as the administration was concerned. when he sacked the judges, when he sort of staged a coup against himself and did all kinds of not very nice things, there was not a word of condemnation or even criticism, even mild criticism, from the administration. And that has been reflected, you know, down the line in the press too.
All right.
So
here,
that's the point.
Julian?
Well, I would just make the point that there is a difference between the news coverage you see in the news pages and the op-eds and the talk you see on cable television. Some of the opinionated talk probably sides more on the Georgian side. But I do feel like if you look at the coverage from the region that reporters from The Washington Post, The New York Times, The LA Times have been pretty unbiased and pretty objective and clear-eyed in the coverage that they've been giving.
I would agree with Julian. We led our Sunday newspaper last week with a story headlined "A Two-Sided Descent into Full-Scale War." It was a very balanced reported piece of work.
All right, let's go to Willard in St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning.
Thank you, Diane. I simply would like to point out that years ago, Russia put a missile base in Cuba. We objected to it. We threatened them. They went out. Now we are doing exactly the same thing in Poland. The missile is a missile, whether it's aimed at a incoming missile or it's simply a weapon of war. And I think Russia has every right to object to us.
Julian.
Well, I would disagree that a missile is a missile. The Soviet Union attempted to put nuclear missiles in Cuba. The interceptors that are going into Poland are not nuclear missiles. They are through the force of their kinetic energy, they are supposed to knock down nuclear-tip ballistic missiles. So there's a whole range of armaments, and we let some in some countries and some in other countries.
And to Raleigh, North Carolina. Good morning, Darren.
Good morning. Quick comment. For the longest time, we've been hearing no timetable for withdrawal from Iraq over and over, pounded into our heads over the years. And suddenly, Barack Obama goes to Iraq, comes up with a timetable, and now suddenly Condoleezza Rice comes back with a possible agreement to a timetable. I just want to get a comment on that.
All right. Thanks for calling, Scott.
Yes, I think it has more to do with the process of negotiation that's been taking place between the U.S. and Iraqi officials rather than Barack Obama's visit, that Nouri al-Maliki, the prime minister of Iraq, is demanding this. It's important to him politically. He's under a lot of pressure from within his own Shiite government to secure one, and I believe that's what's driving this move to a timetable more than the American political campaign.
Are you sure of that, Scott?
I'm not sure of it.
I don't think any of us can be.
What was interesting about Barack Obama's visit is that he had been criticized severely for setting out this by both John McCain and by the administration, and that after his visit, the Iraqi government came out right afterwards and said, "We like what he's saying." If you look at the timeline, though, talks on a timeline, these negotiations over the Status of Forces Agreement, which had been taking place for months and months,
right,
had been taking place. I'm not saying that didn't change the dynamic of the negotiation, but I don't think it was he went, then Rice went, and everyone agrees now.
But there does seem to have been stepped-up attention to how we break through on these areas of disagreement. And that seems to have coincided, perhaps, with Barack Obama's trip. Julian.
You know, one thing, the administration has always very publicly said they are against deadlines of any kind. But if you talk privately with the military, and if you look more importantly at what the military has done at different stages of the Iraq war, there are times where they have embraced timelines, where they've put out different timelines for transferring security. And I think that the military command is more comfortable than the civilian leadership of the United States with timelines, as long as you say, to be sure, we can back off them if necessary.
Here's an email from Chris in Ann Arbor, who says, please comment on Tom Friedman's article asserting that the Clinton and Bush administrations both miscalculated on the need to expand NATO right up to Russia's borders, hence creating unnecessary tension. Julian.
It was an interesting article, and the debate over expanding NATO has been a vigorous one all along. There is little doubt that it was handled poorly, that Russia was never convinced that this was not a threat to them, and that at various points the United States said, let's just forget about Russian objections and push through. There had to, you know, if they needed to get agreement or buy-in from the Russians to do this, or they needed to really convince them that it was not aimed at Russia, because historically NATO was aimed at keeping Russia out of Europe. And now this has become a huge obstacle in the U.S.-Russian relationship.
So now you do have a sleeping bear, perhaps, awakening.
Well, I don't know if it ever went to sleep, but certainly Russia sees the revived NATO or NATO creeping closer to its borders as a physical threat.
Scott.
I think that's right. And there's an interesting story in the New York Times this morning about just all of the levers that Russia really does have at its disposal as well. It's very large international arms trade, its importance in talks with Iran, its veto on the UN Security Council.
So why are we doing all this, Scott?
Well, these are commitments we've made to Poland, whether they were right or wrong to begin with. And the administration argues that we are carrying them through.
At 6 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And let's go to Durham, North Carolina. Good morning, David. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I love your show.
Thank you.
I'm just wondering how the U.S. would react if Russia were to, if Mexico got a new president that really wanted to take back all the territory that they lost and made a pact with Canada and decided to have joint war games just several miles from the U.S. border. I don't think we'd react very well to that, would we?
Interesting hypothetical, Julia.
That's right. We would not react very well. The problem here with the Bush administration's approach was the idea that they could promote democracy wherever it was blooming and that they could handle the U.S.-Russia relationship purely between the chemistry between Putin and Bush. And that wasn't accurate. They couldn't do that.
But there was also, and several commentators have made this point, there was also a sense that Russia could be pushed to the side and that the United States could move forward with its own agenda without taking into account sufficiently, perhaps, this giant of a country, this power of a country before the fall of the Soviet Union.
I think that's right. And I think also there's an underestimation of Russian pride, and that Putin very much flourished because he restored a sense of Russian nationalism and pride in the very desperate days following the collapse of the Soviet Union. And I think that there may have been an underestimation on our part as well on what that emotional sort of response to foreign policy that we engage in as well really plays in Russian politics.
So where do we go from here? How do we maintain a stable relationship with our allies, including Russia, whom, as you've said, we clearly need?
Well, diplomacy, I mean, is the simple word that isn't all that enlightening. But talking, as Julian said, you know, we have to engage them. We have to realize that there are real Russian interests that we may not understand, but that they are deeply held, and talk to them about these issues and try to convince them, maybe too late in the game, that NATO on their doorstep is actually not a threat, that the missile shield is actually not directed towards them, and just keeping at this.
Scott Wilson, foreign editor of The Washington Post, Julian Barnes, Pentagon reporter for The Los Angeles Times, and Khaled Hassan, U.S. correspondent for Daily Times and The Friday Times of Lahore, Pakistan. Thank you all so much. I'll be off next Monday and Tuesday. Hope to be back with you on Wednesday. Have a great weekend, all. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, and Tanya Weinberg, with help from Susan Neighbors. The engineer is Andrew Chadwick. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.